I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
From the number 14 hipster city in the United States, we welcome you, wherever you are, to an oh-so-hip edition of The Political Breakfast. According to new polling, the Georgia governor's race remains virtually tied, while outside help pours into both major party candidates. And we'll check to see if the fight over Judge Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination will affect how Georgians cast their ballots. And a couple of streets with old Confederate names got new ones. Glad to have your company. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining us again, Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, a former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Hi, guys. Welcome back.
Happy Friday.
It's good to be here, Dennis.
And let's start, of course, with what everyone's been talking about, the fight over Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination. The effects here, though. Theron, according to an NPR poll, Republicans have narrowed the enthusiasm gap that they had with Democrats even several weeks ago in terms of motivating themselves to get out to the polls. Kavanaugh apparently has a lot to do with that. Did Democrats in Georgia sit back and watch the national Democrats blow it in the fight over Kavanaugh?
Anytime a Republican, he or she, is faced with opposition from Democrats, whether legitimate or not, it does have this unique ability to rally the Republicans. And then what you saw from President Trump, who went and basically made a mockery out of Dr. Ford, who I think Brian and I both agree should have testified. She did testify. And even the president himself and Senator Grassley, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, said she gave a credible testimony. And so what's happening now is, I think, Dennis, is that, you know, white America, particularly white Republican America, because there's really less than 10% of African Americans who vote for Republicans across the United States, is sort of seeing one of their own sort of being questioned and one of their own sort of being held accountable for some of the actions that he allegedly committed. And what I mean by that is some of the drinking problems that I think that he's admitted that he had back early in his career. And so what Donald Trump is doing, which is very unique, is that he is firing up this base. But I just truly believe that if you are an educated, sensible person, and yes, you probably belong to the Republican Party, I just don't think you can legitimately say that you approve of the behavior of Kavanaugh and how he responded to the senators when being questioned. And you definitely cannot approve of how President Trump is basically mocking a woman.
But President Trump was able to rally Republicans nationwide to defend Brett Kavanaugh from what they felt was an unfair process, whatever they thought about Dr. Ford's testimony. So when it comes to the election here, which is just weeks away, do Democrats have some ground to make up when they thought they were actually being able to pick up some ground?
Well, I think what Democrats have got to do is that we've got to remind the American people that there was a judge out there in George Garland who basically was nominated by President Obama, who was a very credible, I think in a lot of sense, probably more credible than Judge Kavanaugh, who didn't even get the decency to even have a hearing. Republicans not only filibustered, they blocked him. And Democrats were outraged about this. And so now we hear Republicans sort of whining about a process where there was legitimate, credible witnesses who came forward with legitimate, incredible, alleged incidents that they said happened that he had to respond to. And then the FBI and the president himself thought it was enough credibility for him to reopen this investigation.
But is that an effective strategy to use in the closing weeks of a campaign to help Stacey Abrams and the rest of the Democratic ticket here?
So Dennis, you're going to bring it home. So right now we know Brian Kemp is struggling to consolidate the Republican base. Brian will admit to you, and I do hang out at some of the fancy country clubs around town, and I do go to some of the beer hangouts in East Atlanta, and I see some Republicans. They are trying to do the best that they can to rally behind Brian Kemp. Brian Kemp's campaign is doing an enormous amount of outreach to try to consolidate the Republican base around him. So, yes, by President Trump and now Senator Perdue, which I saw a gentleman who I thought was a true statesman, go to the Senate floor and sort of push back in a very Trumpian tone that I have not seen for him. So, yeah, this is a political move from Republicans to rally a base of people in Georgia behind their gubernatorial nominee that is doing his best to try to consolidate that Republican base.
I tweeted about that NPR poll that showed that the Democrats had managed against all odds to give gas to the Republican cause this November. They saw a blue wave coming and they decided to build a red wall. And they have stopped their own momentum. And you're seeing Republicans energized for the first time since 2016. You're seeing in the polling that they are as likely to vote as Democrats now, that they are as motivated as Democrats now. And that's all because of Democrats and their actions and how they responded to these hearings. You want to talk about how Donald Trump talked about Dr. Ford? Republicans are responding to how Richard Blumenthal and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris treated Brett Kavanaugh on the hearing even before these charges came out. They were hostile. They called him evil. They called him a threat to the Constitution and to our democracy. Chuck Schumer said minutes after the nomination was announced that they were going to fight him with all they had. This has been complete obstructionism. This is all about keeping a conservative off of the Supreme Court. Here's the thing, is that their obstructionary tactics are going to prevent them from winning in November. What happened this week? It was the first time in this election since the primaries that Brian Kemp has had a lead in any poll put out in public.
Still a statistical tie in the last poll we've seen as we get together and tape this podcast.
It is a statistical tie, that's true, but it was largely a statistical tie before, but you were consistently seeing him 2 to 3 points down, which is a statistical tie. But now you're seeing them 2 points up. So you are seeing a bit of a swing. You are seeing some change in momentum. And it is because of Republicans coming home in the wake of the Kavanaugh hearings, which left them outraged. And when I tweeted that NPR poll that we've mentioned, a friend of mine responded, Atlanta-ing. Atlanta-ing. That's when you've got it won, it's in the bag, and then you somehow find a creative way to blow it. Like we did in the Super Bowl, like we do in the playoffs, like UGA did against Alabama last year. We found a creative way to lose. That is the Atlanta way, and the Democrats are learning from us.
So I think this is the thing that Brian has a little amnesia. You know, when he and I started doing sort of our road show and having this sort of very spirited bantering that we do, is that his majority leader, Mitch McConnell, said, and I quote, that we were going to do everything we can to basically make sure that Barack Obama and everyone on the Democratic side don't win. And he also said, the majority leader now, Senator McConnell, then the minority leader, said we're going to do everything we can to stop Obamacare. So this sort of obstructionist that he's now sort of this label that he's put on Democrats, you know, if anything, we learned it from the Republicans because the Republicans spent 8 years of basically trying to—
Barking was not done by Republicans, and that is where this started 30 years ago.
You can get circular with this. Yeah, he started it. No, she started it. No, he started it.
We know where it started.
But the thing I think that I am optimistic about, Dennis, and I did see this NPR poll, and I've actually seen polling here locally that shows that majority of people do not think that Kavanaugh should be approved in the hearing, should be voted to be to go to the next level, is that I do think that women are the key to this, because what I hear around town is that a lot of women feel like if this happened to any woman, a woman should have an opportunity to be heard and they should have an opportunity to testify. But there are some women who said that this happened, you know, 30 years ago plus. You know, it's unfortunate, but should it be coming out now? You know, Kavanaugh was young. So I think what Democrats have done is that I think we have taken the side of, I believe, the majority of women to question this gentleman who is running to be, who is wanting to be in a lifetime appointment at the Supreme Court. And so while it may have probably motivated some Republicans who needed the motivation because they're not really that enthused about Brian Kemp, I do think that it helped the Abrams campaign, it helped Democrats nationally to really tap into sort of a sensitive sort of humanization feeling that I think a lot of women have about this particular incident.
I don't say this to Theron very often, but wrong, 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 wrong. And here's why. That those women, the women that have peeled off of the Republican Party, white college-educated women, were already motivated to vote for Democrats. They were already revved up. The Democratic base was already revved up. They were going at full steam. When you're at 10, you can't go to 11. 10 is where the top is. They're at 10. And Republicans weren't. We were nowhere near 10. And we are now kind of getting closer to parity when it comes to energy. And a lot of women that haven't peeled off, that perhaps were just not that interested or maybe a little concerned about the president's tone or whatever, but we're still Republicans, like all of a sudden, they are fired up and ready to go vote for Brian Kemp and a bunch of other Republicans.
Brian, the polls, though, show a huge gender gap with men and women here in Georgia when it comes to party affiliation, party turnout.
Yes.
With women definitely voting in big numbers, if they show up, for Democrats.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Brian Kemp, in his latest ad, seems like a totally different person than the one portrayed in his ads in the primary. No guns, no guy dating your daughter, just women attacking Stacey Abrams over child sex offenders. So where was that guy with his pickup getting ready to round up illegal immigrants?
Well, there's always a pivot to the general where you talk about different issues. And I said after he won the primary that he would shed a lot of those strategies and go a different route. And that I said he had a lot of open field to go toward because he had not talked about a lot of general election issues in the primary where he had backed himself into a corner. He was able to stake out new ground, and that's what you're seeing him doing on these issues. And it's the right strategy for the general election. It's interesting to me that Stacey Abrams has not pivoted to the middle, that she has stayed with her left-wing policies and is out there talking about those. She believes, and maybe she's right, I don't know, maybe Theron knows, she believes that there are no voters in the middle, that the only path to victory for Democrats is to rev up the base of the Democratic Party to change the electorate by bringing disaffected liberals back into the electorate. But the fact is, right now, you've got a 49-43% of Georgians who want Brett Kavanaugh confirmed to the Supreme Court. It's a big enough of a margin that this is a positive issue for Republicans, one that we've struggled to find, one that's been motivating and sort of captivated the voters. So it's a net positive for Republicans, and we have been desperate to have a net positive.
Theron, the Democrats have said all along that in order to win, they have to turn out voters who haven't come out before in minority communities and the young. How is that going in light of all of this? It's hard to tell whether grassroots voter turnout efforts are effective.
Early voting would be the first indication we will have, Dennis, that we will probably see some uprise with these infrequent and sporadic voters. But we truly won't know until Election Day if the Abrams strategy works. Now, I want to push back on this notion, and I've heard from people from the Abrams campaign. I hope they're listening because I want to make sure I get this out. Number one, they're not registering voters, all right? So the Abrams campaign is not registering voters. There's some Republican whisper campaign out there that they're somehow out here registering all these voters. There are other organizations, Dennis, that have a massive amount of organization. It really reminds me of President Obama's operation that I had the pleasure of being a part of in 2012 when they registered hundreds and hundreds of thousands of voters across America. Number two, Abrams' campaign, they have made a pivot to the middle. Let me tell you this, and Brian knows this. He watches TV. I mean, I'm sure he has a 75-inch plus TV in his office. Is that when you see the Democrats
showing Georgia games all the time?
Right, and he's probably got the four screens, you know, where he can actually watch the Georgia game, watch Fox News, and watch local television. But when you are a Democratic nominee for governor, and you put the incumbent Republican governor in a commercial, if that's not going to the middle, then what is? I mean, for her to basically say, I have worked with this governor, that's one pivot. Secondly, what she's come out and said recently is that she sort of said, hey, you know what? I may want to reevaluate my position on the tax cuts. That's a pivot to the middle. But what the Republicans want you to believe is that she's too extreme for Georgia. And a lot of women are being turned off by that because this whole too extreme is really trying to paint this woman who is more educated than Brian Kemp, who has, if not, and that's number one. And I think we won't ever challenge her intellectual ability to do the job, right?
To coin a phrase, right. She went to Yale.
She did go to Yale.
And so did Brett Kavanaugh.
And so,
did they drink together?
No, I don't think she actually had too many opportunities to drink with Kavanaugh at Yale. But this is a woman who is not being judged on merits. See, what the Kemp campaign and Republicans have done is that they got us talking about Kavanaugh, which I truly believe, Dennis, that the Georgia voter, who I still believe these disaffected Republican, suburban, college-educated women, are not so much focused on Kavanaugh in order to determine who they're going to vote for governor. It's coming down to jobs, it's coming down to education, and it's coming down to health care. And I think if Stacey Abrams' candidacy is judged on those three things and the merits to basically be able to do the job, I think that she can legitimately have a chance to appeal to these voters. But unfortunately, Dennis, is that, you know, these millennials and these sort of people who have not come out traditionally, we really haven't seen a lot of these Democratic sporadic and infrequent voters since 2008. I do think that the campaign from on Abrams' behalf has spent an enormous amount of time coming out to them. And then the last thing I want to say is this. I believe that what's really not good for Abrams is time. Up until this sort of these polls come out, you clearly could say that the Abrams campaign had the momentum. I think they still have the momentum. I think if the election had been this past Tuesday, I think she probably would have squeaked out a victory, or it could have possibly gone to a runoff, because we are also negating
the fact. Yeah, we do have a Libertarian in the race.
We have a Libertarian in the race, Dennis, who's not only getting Republicans voting for him, but he's also getting some Democrats. Mm-hmm. And these are some Democrats that the Abrams campaign need to pull back. So, look,
what we've seen in polling this week is that more Democrats are being pulled off by the Libertarian than Republicans, which I thought was interesting. It's usually not that way.
Right. So what's happening? It's all this chaos in Washington. It's all this chaos that Trump has created. Brian can't come on this podcast and legitimately say that Donald Trump is a compassionate conservative of the Republican Party. He has made an attempt and has succeeded to destroy the Republican Party, and he's destroyed the Democratic Party. It's now the Trump Party. And the Trump Party has this unique coalition of angry but fired up, you know, middle class and sort of not so middle class white voters. And believe it or not, there are some people of color who do think that this economy is going well. And so I think the Abrams campaign, I just want to commend her. I think that she is running a very disciplined campaign. She has not had any big unforced errors. She's able to respond to the attacks. You know, for a long time in Democrats in the state, Dennis, the Republicans will go out here and attack you for weeks, and you don't even have the resources to push back. And so what you've seen her do is she actually has gone on the offense against Brian Kemp. Well, now the Republicans are going on TV with these very attractive and articulate white women and saying that these are false attacks against Kemp. And so, you know, again, I think that in 2018, Abrams is running a really good campaign, and I think we should not underscore that.
Let me finish up with this. On the white educated women, they don't like Trump. We know that. Data-driven, we know they don't like him. But I would imagine they also largely don't like Maxine Waters and Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren, Bill de Blasio, the communist mayor of New York City. These people have all come out in favor of Stacey Abrams. And that is far, far out of the mainstream. And it really plays into Brian Kemp's message that she's too extreme for Georgia without him even lifting a finger. She's telling the story for him that this is not how Georgia works. Those are not Georgia values. I don't see how that strategy is going to work. But on women, what concerns me as a Republican, and I said this to a group I spoke to last week, in polling, women of all races, ages 18 to 32 or 34, somewhere in there, are voting for Stacey Abrams by a margin of 73 to 16. And that should terrify Republicans, because most of these guys who are in the state house, who are in rural districts, they're going to be fine for a long time. There's going to be Republican areas for a long time. But for in-town districts where you have a dynamic economy, you have new people and young people moving in, it is a lot of green shoots there for Democrats, and we have got to make sure that our coalition keeps evolving with our population, or Democrats will control this state, and it could be as early as this cycle.
If not this cycle, the next one. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
In Metro Atlanta, 29-county region, Nathan Deal won it by 50,000 votes in 2010. In 2014, Jason Carter won it by 5,000, a 55,000 vote swing.
Swing, yeah.
And the votes outside of Metro Atlanta stayed the same, about 205 to 207,000 for Republicans, a margin for Republicans. And then you fast forward 2 years later to 2016, and Hillary Clinton wins Metro Atlanta by 8 points. So you're seeing a dramatic shift, and it's all happening in Metro Atlanta, as the rest of the state pretty much stays the same, but it's not growing fast enough to keep up.
But real quick, so what you just heard Brian do is this sort of dog whistle to white rural Georgians, these Georgia values. And I think if you actually, you know, it's very interesting, you know, because it gives the inference, and it implies that Stacey Abrams can't be one of them, or cannot embody, or cannot articulate the Georgia values. Because is it because of her gender? Is it because of her race? Or is it because she's talking about the closing of rural hospitals? You know, when you're running for governor and you're Brian Kemp and you have 7 words on your website, Brian knows this. Brian would have told Brian Kemp, hey, man, we at least got to put 70 words up there. But when you got 7 words on your website about healthcare, see, the one thing that I think Abrams has done very intelligently, and Brian has a point, she has focused heavily on the metro area, but what we don't see here sitting in these zip codes that we are in Atlanta is really the conversations that are going on in rural Georgia. And I'm telling you, and I think that this is sort of pathway. If you are in rural Georgia, whether it's southwest, southeast, northeast, northwest Georgia, and you have a governor who, number one, is going to try to protect public education, because that white Georgian who embodies these Georgia values probably don't have the resources to send all of their kids to private schools, so they have to depend on public schools, right? But a lot of people do what? The American dream is to go out and buy a house, be able to afford a house in a neighborhood that has a good public school system. And so when you have a gubernatorial candidate saying that she wants to protect private public schools and protect them from being privatized, I think that in healthcare and having a plan to keep rural hospitals open is something that's going to resonate with them.
We should point out here that Brian Kemp has now come out with more than a 7-word healthcare plan, and that will be the subject of debates, two of which they've actually committed to, one from the Atlanta Press Club and one from Channel 2. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of The Political Breakfast. Stay with us.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we are back with The Political Breakfast. Happy you stayed with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Brian Robinson, Republican strategist and former Deputy Chief of Staff to Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is here, too. He's a Democratic strategist, former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Let's shift to local politics, the Gulch. Theron, I'll start with you. Forces allied with Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms tried to get that big redevelopment plan through City Council a few weeks ago. They held off. Does the mayor have the votes to pass it in the next council meeting, which is October 15th, this after some public meetings, or does she wait and say, okay, I'm going to hold off even longer, which might give the opposition time to build?
You know, I can't say that she has the votes right now because, you know, she can speak on that better than I can, but I will tell you that I think that she's in a much better position on this whole entire deal than she was a few weeks ago. Let's also remind our listeners, Dennis, is that the mayor proactively said, hey, after I've heard many, many sort of questions from the council that are legitimate questions, and then also I've heard from the community, she proactively showed some leadership and said, you know what, we're not going to encourage Cleta Winslow, who is the author of this ordinance and this legislation.
Well, that's because the Gulch is in her district.
Because it's in her district. So they made a decision not to bring it up. And then what she did, which I thought was an exceptional move, is that she brought in a host of experts that really, for 2 hours, Dennis, just went detail by detail this deal, and Burt Brantley from the Georgia Office of Economic Development on behalf of Governor Deal to really talk about really the amount of money that the state is putting into this.
But the council voted down the idea of an outside review.
So here we go. So what she did with this hearing is that she allowed people to come to the hearing, and she did ask the constituents to write down their questions, not to prohibit folks from being heard, but to really have an orderly and productive hearing where every question that was presented in writing was asked. And so I want to push back on this narrative from some of the folks in the community that wanted to say that she was trying to take away people's ability to actually speak at the hearing. So then we move forward to the following week, Dennis, and then there was an ordinance that was introduced by a member of council to basically call for an independent study. So what Mayor Bottoms did, and I think this is what we're going to see a lot from this mayor, she proactively went out and had robust conversations with the Georgia Municipal Association, who she announced Monday before they voted down the piece of legislation that the council member walked in as a personal paper to bring an independent study. So the mayor knew that there was sort of this really kind of back door dealing kind of with council members and say, all right, not only are we going to just try to stall the deal, but we're also going to ask for an independent study. So it was really leadership on her part to go out and truly get an independent organization, to truly go out and hire
the Georgia Municipal Association.
Yeah, to hire someone independent. So now where are we? So the council has gotten what they wanted. They got more time, which they asked for. They got an independent study because really if the council members' legislation had went through, the city would have hired this firm. And truly, you guys know, and Brian knows this as well, once you get hired by entity, you're quote-unquote no longer then independent. So now it comes down to, okay, what comes back from this study? And then what kind of room is left in the deal to really continue to educate council members and the constituencies about really the economic impact, and particularly around affordable housing? And I think that's the one thing that I've seen the conversation shift from people having questions about the deal to really wanting to know, hey, how much more can we get?
200 units, apparently, of affordable housing in exchange for nearly $2 billion in public financing. Brian, is that a good deal?
I'm not smart enough to know. So what I do is rely on third-party validators. And the people who have and groups who have come out in favor of this include the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, which is made up of community-conscious, not just business-conscious leaders in this city. And, of course, my old boss, Governor Nathan Deal. He has nothing to gain from this. He's leaving office. This is about taking a prime piece of real estate that has been underutilized, that is an eyesore, and turning it into something that over the decades and over the generations will be a major tax revenue driver. We have so many exciting things going on around that area. There at the World Congress Center complex, which was right next door, we have a 1,000-room hotel going up. It's, you know, it's going to be a high-end hotel there by Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Another tremendous asset for this community. So we're going to turn this into a very special plot of land that's going to be a destination. It's going to be a place where you can live, work, and play, and it's going to be a good community investment. Now, I understand why taxpayers in Atlanta are leery of any big expenditure by the city right now. Obviously, questions have been raised about the propriety and wisdom of some of the spending done in the last few years. I think that the credibility of Mayor Bottoms is crucial in this. voters have got to trust her leadership and they've got to trust her character. Now, Theron's good friends with her. He was certainly vouched for her character. I don't know her that at all. And she's got to prove to people like me who are watching her from afar that we can trust her. And if she can do that, she can be a mayor that can transform the face of Atlanta.
The question is not just affordable housing, Theron. It's also the financing that the city would be and the tax revenue the city would be giving up in the future. I mean, this isn't existing money that they're pumping in. It's future money that the schools, for instance, have agreed to give up. If you're a council member from another district and you're looking at, well, this is future projects that I'm giving up, possibly in my district, for my neighborhood, for areas at risk in other parts of the city, how do you make that case?
Well, that's one. I'm so glad you asked me about that, because we know that there's a certain person going around town right now who is the superintendent of APS who's really talking bad about this deal, and I want to call her out. One thing that is so false is that there is going to be literally $0 that come out of the city's general fund for this project. And what we're talking about is tax allocation districts. We're talking about bonds. That is no new money right now, but it's going to be money that's going to be generated over time. Now, I learned this, and this is something I got to compliment the governor's office and the state on. I think right now in Fulton County, the city of Atlanta, Fulton County, the sales tax is roughly about 8.9%. The state is going to forego its 4.3% of that 8.9% sales tax to basically devote giving that back to the city to fund this project. So I'm not a mathematician, but I know that if the state is agreeing to do that for, you know, how many years of this project, that's a significant investment. And I've learned in business, Dennis, and Brian knows this because we run our own companies, is that if you ain't got nothing to bring to the table, if you don't have any skin in the game, then keep your mouth shut. And so my thing is this. For those, and I'm going to call her name out, is out here actively talking about all this money that APS stands to lose or stands to gain going down the future. Okay, you may feel that way. But don't interfere with this deal and go out here and trash publicly or privately a mayor who has worked with you. The last thing I want to say is this. What you have seen from Mayor Bottoms, Cassine Reed would have never agreed to have a public hearing and then let certain former senators and former elected officials and these white people come in and are talking about gentrification, which actually baffles me that these white people all of a sudden now in Atlanta want to care about gentrification. He would have never done that. This was a gentleman for 8 years who, with the support of the state, would go and present a deal to the council and would tell them, vote it up or down. So I think what has changed, Dennis, and this is why I'm so passionate about this, is that this mayor has come into a different culture in the city because it's all this media attention about how money is being spent. And so I think that this mayor is showing a great deal of patience. I think that she's doing her best to work with a lot of these seven new council members. And for APS and their leader to sit around and educate you, Dennis, and all these other third parties and tell them that this deal is going to take away from APS is very disingenuous. And I wanted to call her out.
And we should note here, the broadcast license for WABE is held by the Atlanta Board of Education. A couple of very quick hits here as we wrap up. Renaming Confederate Avenue and a couple of other streets with the name Confederate in them. Mayor Bottoms just signed the ordinance to do that. It's like three streets. United Avenue is the new name for Confederate Avenue itself. Theron, will there be more of this? Because a commission set up by former Mayor Reed recommended a whole lot of changes, including monuments, memorials, other streets. Is this just the beginning, or is this as far as it goes?
This is something that I think is going to be part of Mayor Reed's legacy. He had the courage and really the audacity to really confront a issue that has been going on a long time in our city about some of the streets that were sort of named and renamed after Confederate soldiers in the Confederacy. I do think that now for her to receive the amount of support and recommendations for this committee, it will be a sort of growing trend to continue to have conversations about other streets in the region.
Brian, do you think that what's happening here in Atlanta will stimulate conversations in other parts of the state where Confederate monuments and memorials sometimes occupy the center of town squares, often in heavily African-American areas?
And I believe in local control on these issues. And that's why I don't have a problem with what Atlanta is doing. I believe that democracy should be allowed to play out. Now, as far as the monuments and statues in town squares and county courthouse circles, state law protects those. So you would have to see a Democratic takeover of the General Assembly to get that changed. Now, you could add to those monuments, and this is something Jim Galloway at the AJC talks about a lot, is that you could add things that provide context to those monuments. That's perfectly legal, and I'm sure in some areas local leaders will want to do that, and that's their right. But when it comes to the overall state electorate, preserving these monuments and not taking them down, not defacing them, polls off the charts, particularly with Republican voters, obviously. It is something that brings out a lot of passion, and I think it's going to be something we're continuing to discuss for a long time because I think that the divide is going to last for a long time.
One other quick thought. This has been an awful week for the Atlanta VA. The Department of Veterans Affairs ranked it as one of the worst VA facilities in the nation, or among the worst. And then the AJC reported inspectors found a ton of hazardous waste packed into a building that resulted in a fine of $13,600. The chair of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee is Georgia Republican Johnny Isaacson. He has held field hearings at the VA in Atlanta. He's expressed confidence in the VA leadership here so far. Brian, what kind of position does this put him in?
Johnny has spoken out on this for years now and has led on this and has demanded change, and it just keeps being one setback after another. Now, I do think that what you're seeing here is the long-term consequences of government-run health care. This is what happens when government runs health care.
The only problem here is, and the VA is a special case, because a lot of the services, specialized services that the VA offers, would not survive at all in the private sector because they are so specialized and they have so few patients and they are so expensive.
Well, certainly the veterans population poses unique challenges and they have unique needs because they serve their nation and receive unique wounds and unique problems. And we as taxpayers owe it to them to give them the health care that they need. But obviously, we have failed in our duty to them because they're not getting the health care that they need, and the record shows that clearly. Going back to third-party validators, we keep talking about this, but there's none that I trust any more than I do Johnny Isaacson. I mean, here is someone who is passionate about these issues. If he tells me that the turnaround is in effect, that this is going to be better, that the leaders that we have in place are the right leaders to enact change, then I believe that.
You know, President Trump won on the phrase, make America great again, right? Well, and he's someone who really prides himself on sort of being a supporter of our military and our veterans. I would, you know, encourage Senator Isaacson to not only remind President Trump of that slogan, but also to tell him make our veteran affairs facilities livable again. Because one of the things that I dealt with while working in Congressman Barrow's office, who's a former congressman from Georgia's 12th mm-hmm. district, and also in Congressman Lewis's office here in Georgia's 5th district, is the number one complaint we received, Dennis, was from veterans complaining about the conditions of these veteran centers. And also not only complaining about the conditions, but also complaining about the delay of getting funding that they deserve, that they were promised when they go over and protect us in foreign land. And so I think this is something that Senator Isaacson has got to really figure out a way to maybe lean on his good pal, Senator Perdue, to really say, hey, we need more federal dollars. We need to really pay close attention to this because it has been an issue that I have been hearing about for over a decade now. And this whole notion that it's, you know, blamed on federal government sort of getting into health care, Brian may have a point on that. But I think to your point, Dennis, is that these are services. These are health care services that these veterans earned and that they were promised and that they should be able to receive when they come back. And so I think it's just unacceptable to have a federal facility with the conditions that it's in that these articles laid out. I mean, it's just really deplorable.
Finally, Atlanta ranked 14th among cities for hipsters, according to MoveHub's Hipster Index. Okay, jokes aside, because there are plenty that one could throw in here. Brian, isn't this, in a way, a good thing for everyone, because hipsters often, because they're hipsters, are ahead of trends that eventually work their way into the mainstream. And Atlanta can be looked at as a city that's innovating and that will attract more folks.
We are a dynamic economy under Republican leadership, and I think that that is paying off.
The hipster Republicans.
Well, they're here enjoying the economy that is humming here. It's one of the best in the country. And, you know, part of why the conversation in 2016 about parts of America being left behind didn't resonate so much here in Metro Atlanta is because things are going great here, and people are moving here, and those folks— the ones that I come into contact with aren't bankers and lawyers. They're in service industry jobs, like in the restaurant industry, and that's where I see them. And those parts of our economy are doing fantastic. So it's just a great sign about our economy.
I think that not only does the Republican leadership get credit for this, I think you also got to give local leaders and city leaders credit, and also organizations like Invest Atlanta and others who have really ensured that we have affordable housing for a lot of these hipsters to want to live in some of these areas where they don't want to move out in the suburb areas. They actually want to live in town. So Atlanta is sort of this growing—
Can that continue, though, with the prices going the way they are?
Well, the prices are going up because you have high demand. I think, you know, this article that you just referenced showed that everyone wants to live in Atlanta because we're this great international city. We have the world's busiest, most efficient airport. A lot of folks in the state don't believe that. Mm-hmm. And Dale Caldwell, who I actually want to call out, too, mm-hmm. I think gave a very not factual—
And there's the concern about existing communities, if people moving in, hip or not, push existing communities out.
Yeah, and so I think that the mayor, with her, again, billion-dollar pledge, I hope Brian will chip in, I know I will, and maybe we can get some of our clients to help with this goal that the mayor has, is to make sure that when these hipsters and others, folks want to move into our city, that the folks who have been longstanding residents of our city can afford to stay here and not be displaced. And so, again, I think it just shows that Atlanta is heading in the right direction.
It's also great for whatever industry does the thing that pokes the hole in your earlobe and puts that ring in there, whatever that is. It's the most baffling thing in the world to me. I think I see that and I go, that you're going to regret that one day. That's not going to age well.
A year from now, Brian, we're going to check your earlobes.
And I tell you what, if you have any problems, you know, my fiance is a dermatologist, and one of the things that she does very well is dealing with people who've had those earrings and they develop these sort of keloids and stuff. So, Brian, if it doesn't go so well for you in about a year, just come see me.
It goes to my point about it not aging well, but it's also apparently helping the dermatology industry. That's fantastic. It's great for Theron.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Joining us again today, Republican strategist Brian Robinson, a former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, a former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dennis, and happy birthday to my daughter, Quinn Paces.
And big shout out to Tiger for being back.
And if you like this show, subscribe. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. And we'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.